It's time for the Mainland Podcast, end of season edition. I believe we're at episode 35. I'm Michael Citro from themainland.com, managing editor and founder, and I am joined by Andrew Harrison and Daniel McGann this week, and we've sadly come to the end of our season, guys, and there was no decision day miracle coming for Orlando City, I'm sad to say.
Yeah, you know, it was a little bit too much to hope for with that 8-goal differential not in our favor going into the weekend, especially with New York City not really having anything to play for against New England. But, you know, it was a good stretch down the end of the season. Really excited for next year coming up because it looks like we built a lot of depth this year, and the young players came along through the season, and Adrian kind of learned his way through MLS, so it's going to be exciting.
You know, we got zero of the many things that we needed to have happen. We got none of them. Not one thing panned out. No Orlando City win, no New York City FC win, and certainly no goal differential made up. Andrew, couldn't have been a more disappointing finale for me. I mean, no goals, 8 yellow cards, one turning into a double yellow card, which was a red for Chris Nigueta, who will miss the season opener next year. And officiating decisions were, I'm not going to say they were all bad, but I will say enough of them were bad that affected the game and kind of got in the players' heads. And probably that early goal for New England being, you know, sort of relayed to the team, it sort of looked to me like the effort wasn't great.
Yeah, I think they started the game sluggishly and it just continued from there. Yes, we had some bad refereeing on, not in our favor. Penso had a propensity for just yellow carding everybody, but it just didn't look like, I think we kind of knew going in that we needed so many things to go in our favor, and for a lot of people that were playing, it just didn't seem like it was even worth trying to get there, because it wasn't in our own hands. They played like that, and it was hard to watch at times.
Yeah, it was a bit disappointing. You know, Kyle Larin played up top, and you would almost not even know he was on the pitch for a lot of the time because there was no one getting him the ball. We didn't see anything crisp from Carlos Rivas on the left side. Vinter tried on the right side. He worked, you know, his typical hard work rate, but not a lot going on there. Adrian Heath decided to start Breck Shea at right back instead of Rafael Ramos, and you know, the width that was provided by Philadelphia was basically ceded to Shea on the right. And Shea is not a right-footed player, so predictably he'd get the ball forward and basically turn it over with a horrible cross. Daniel, are you a little bit surprised that Shea played on the right side rather than either Ramos or Corey Ash, who had played there previously and done a good job? Did you think that Shea, number one, where did you think Shea would start, I guess is my question.
I honestly thought Shea would start on the left side. I thought Ramos would be on the right. Bowden would be that guy off the bench if you needed him. But it just looked like Heath went for it with the lineup. I mean, we saw, you know, Larin up top again, but we really saw, you know, Vinter and Kaká and Rivas behind him. And we saw our two stalwarts in defensive midfield. And I think he was thinking Breck Shea could basically play three back with Bowden, Collin, and Hines, and Breck Shea could get up the field, which he was doing. There was nothing good at the end of it when he got up there, and then he didn't really track back. And our team looked a little sluggish, too. I think the comment both you guys already had, I think they ran themselves out the past, you know, 6 matches, and we could see that. They put a lot on the field at the end of the season, and they fought back to that, you know, conversation of maybe making the playoffs, even though we did need a lot to go our way. But I was very surprised to see Shea on the right side. If anything, on the left side at left back or perhaps somewhere in the midfield where he's been really dangerous further up the field.
Yeah, I kind of thought that we would see Shea actually play right wing where the crossing wouldn't be as big of an issue. I thought Vinter would be off the bench. I thought we would see our best offensive team. So I really thought we would see Shea on the right side of Kaká and Rivas with Ramos back and behind him. And I don't know, Andrew. I mean, maybe it's just me, but you finally don't put Lewis Neal in the starting lineup, and look what happens.
Yeah, that's what I was coming to next. I was kind of shocked that he didn't get the start. Coach is one of those, like, he's stuck with him throughout the parts of the season when people have lamented his performances, but we were winning, and the one time he doesn't start and he moves it around, we don't get the points that we need. And I think that was potentially really the worst part of going into that game, was that there were so many changes and there were people being played out of position. It seemed weird to not go with as cohesive a team as possible. Why play people out of position when realistically to get the goals that we needed, you needed everybody playing 100% at the right place in the right time. And to make people play out of position just didn't seem the best decision that we could have had. We had a virtually full healthy squad, and we didn't really use it to its advantage.
Yeah, it's interesting that to me, I would have probably tried to put my, maybe a strong, solid 11 out there to try to grab the lead. Once you have the lead, then you can go for goals and go for goal differential. Mm-hmm. It seemed like he just tried to do that right off the bat and send out all his offensive players. But, you know, that's a strategy. If it works, he's a genius, and it didn't particularly work on this night. But I don't think it was necessarily a coaching issue. It didn't look like the team was in the game from the get-go. Gave up some pretty good chances early in the game. And then, really, even when they had possession and time on the ball, they just didn't really do much once they crossed midfield. It wasn't even the final third. It was once they crossed midfield, it was just a turnover waiting to happen. We saw numerous players not really moving, and thus, their through ball attempts were just going off the shins of the guys in front of them, the defenders, rather than going through to the guys they were trying to pass to. Daniel, two games against Philadelphia this year, which has conceded a ton of goals, and Orlando City was not able to muster a single goal. What do you make of that?
Confusion up front. I remember the first time we played, it was just like everybody was confused. They didn't know where to make the run, and it kind of looked that way again this match. Like you said, a few players were just standing around waiting for something to happen rather than, taking it on themselves to make a run and make a good pass and take a shot. I mean, come on, Kyle Larin, he tallied one shot the entire night. That's insane to me for somebody that was so as hot as he was going into this match. I don't want to say it's not disconcerting, right? Because we won 5 out of 6 matches in the end of the year. Our form was by far the best that it's ever been this season. And but against a team that we wouldn't necessarily call, we wouldn't have in high regard in the Eastern Conference, you would expect more points against Philly in the season. But sometimes it just comes down that way, right? We played really well against the Western Conference, and against these Eastern Conference stellar teams, we weren't stellar.
No. And there were times when, they had people in good positions and no one would shoot the ball and they'd overpass and then eventually lose the ball. And it was at some point just be selfish and take a shot and you never know what's going to happen. I think the best chance for Orlando City was Kaká expected Adrian Venter to make a run. He did not make a run and he got yelled at afterwards for that. But the ball did somehow slip through and Venter got a shot off that Blake had to make a save on. And then I think the next best chance didn't come until the end of the game when Pedro Ribeiro came on and got the ball from a bad angle, turned and fired, and Blake made a really sharp save from close range. But why don't we get to our man of the match? I don't think it's any surprise. I did grades again, and my man of the match was Josh Ford, who got his first MLS start and couldn't really do much about the penalty, but kept the team in the game early when things were, little dicey in the defensive third. He made two solid back-to-back saves, reaction saves, and then he made one deceptive save where he just barely got a hand on it and pushed it off the left post, or the right post, his left. And for me, he was the guy who looked most into the game. I thought the center backs played fairly well, and basically no one else played great.
Yeah, I mean, Josh looked fantastic. I mean, with Talley coming down with another knee injury, goalkeeper is going to be something we're going to be talking about over the off season. And he really put a staple on, he could play at this level. He looked athletic. He looked quick. He made some good decisions. coming out of the back, his passing, not necessarily the best, and we've seen, you know, that in the past, but he really put a staple on that that backup goalkeeper position.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with both of you. He was the only player that was worthy of man of the match. He may have made some mistakes, but he looked like he was the one that was most playing for a contract for next season. You know, some of the other guys would be like, yeah, I'm definitely going to be here. And he was actually playing for his career, and he played like that. Okay, he conceded, we lost, but he actually made some great reaction saves. We got to see what he was doing, and he kept us in the game. Without his performance, it would have been a lot worse, and we wouldn't have even had anything to really talk about as a highlight from this game.
Yeah, so good for Josh Ford being our man of the match, a unanimous decision, and I would like it to be unanimous because of the fact that he played so well, but in this case, it's partially unanimous because no one else played well at all. So congratulations to Josh. Good job. But it, you know what's great is his story is that, you know, he's been around the league a few years and has had back-to-back seasons with injuries. He's been sent down. He's been loaned out. He hasn't had a chance to play. And then with this Tally Hall injury, finally, in Orlando City Purple, gets his MLS debut in the New York City game and then gets his first MLS start. So, and, you know, he's given up one goal but no goals from the run of play in his time with Orlando City. So that's something he can hang his hat on and maybe get better at and develop a little more now that he's going to be he's not getting any more minutes this year, but he'll probably get some in this friendly coming up. We'll talk about that a little bit. You know, it was just not a great game to watch. It was frustrating, not just for the team play, but the calls. I think at one point the fouls were like 15-5. And it was, you know, there was one sequence where Laren got knocked down and the ball taken away. And then at the other end, the guy leaves his feet intentionally and the ref gives a free kick in a dangerous area. Like 4 seconds before he gave away, you know, let go a much more physical challenge. And I don't, you know, I don't necessarily think that these referees go into these games with an agenda, but I do think sometimes they go in with some bias. And I think if they looked at the stats, they may predetermine some things. And, you know, sometimes it's just plain old incompetence. I watched the game. I was at the Citrus Bowl, actually, for the U.S. Women's National Team game. And I was watching the game after the U.S. match with Simon Vaness of MLSsoccer.com, and he was just beside himself with the referee not knowing what he was doing. And I find Simon is a fairly objective guy when it comes to officiating decisions. He's not afraid to say, you know, this, you know, you dude screwed up and he shouldn't have done that, and he got his yellow card. He's not an Orlando City homer when it comes to those kind of things. And he was a little bit apoplectic about some of those calls. I thought I don't actually know if Ramos got his yellow for a foul or for the descent afterwards, but I can tell you that Simon was pretty adamant that that wasn't a foul, that he won the ball, you know, fairly. And I thought Bowden's yellow was a foul and only a foul. It wasn't like he was constantly infringing and that he needed to be booked at that point. But Chris Penso definitely inserted himself into the game. I'm torn on the red card because it didn't affect anything. It was obviously a bit of a flop, but at the same time, Chris Nikita has no business touching a guy in the box when the ball's in the corner. So I'm a little bit torn on that, and I think there was a good opportunity for him to even it up with a potential handball later on in the game, and he had none, you know, didn't want anything to do with it. So I would just call it interesting decisions made by the pro referee and leave it at that. But certainly Orlando City wasn't deserving of points in the game, and they definitely didn't get any.
Well, two things that really upset me about this match was Orlando City winning this match, needing to win and needing to win big. And the referee knows this. And then we get, you know, what, 34 fouls, 9 yellows, and a red, which just stops every type of open play that you could possibly imagine for anything, for either team. And Orlando City was just so apprehensive whenever it came to being anywhere near the box. every single person just felt like they needed to pass it to someone else whenever they were close to the 18 instead of just ripping it at goal. No offense, you need 8-9 goals. You need to score as many as you can, and we're taking how many shots on goal? Like that for me is just on both sides of the coin. Like, Orlando didn't do what they needed to do, first of all, so the ref didn't really play that much into it. But if we were doing what we needed to do, then we wouldn't have had the open play to be able to get the goals that we needed in the first place, because there were so many fouls being called. I mean, every time somebody fell to the ground, I feel like there was a whistle being blown. And that doesn't need – that's not football. That's not soccer, right? This is an open, flowing game. Let them play. Call advantage. Come back to the play afterwards. There were so many yellows given for just small little mishaps that this isn't the type of soccer that I want to watch.
Exactly. So we're moving on. We're done with the season, and you know, I think by all, it would have been nice to have gotten that last win and gone out with the winning, the record for the win streak for by an expansion team, and also to tie Seattle's 13 wins and to get to 500 would have been great. But I think that going into the last game, still with a mathematical chance to make the playoffs, is for an expansion team, that's a pretty good season. And if you add in all of the missed games and all of the problems with injuries, suspensions, international call-ups, you have to say not a bad first season in the MLS for Orlando City, Andrew.
No, I mean, when you really roll it all together, we had a great season. We broke attendance records. We played like a team that had, if some games have been around for a really long time, with a really cohesive unit. We learned, I think, really important lessons for going forward towards next season. We learned how to travel like 35,000 miles in a season, and that is something that we hadn't done before. There's lots for us to take forward and to get excited about and know what we need to do to be completely successful in this league, rather than just be like, okay, it was our first season, it's building blocks, now we got to go from here. And I think that was really how we have to judge this season, and you'd have to judge it a success on that.
Yeah, and soccer in Orlando is definitely here to stay. It's definitely a major thing in this city now. I was at the Citrus Bowl, as I mentioned, for the U.S. against Brazil on the victory tour. It was the final game in red, white, and blue for Lori Kolubny and also for Lauren Holiday. So it was a treat for me to be there for that. The U.S. goes in and wins 3-1, and the first goal, just 9 minutes in, scored by none other than Alex Morgan. So, you know, maybe the first of many goals she'll score at the Citrus Bowl. At least, you know, we all hope so, and we know she does as well. 32,000 plus at the Citrus Bowl, another record, a new record for in Florida for a U.S. women's national team game. So, you know, kudos to Orlando coming out to support the U.S. women's national team. I got there 3 hours before the game, and they had sort of a fan zone out set up in one of the parking lots. And there was a really long line to get your picture taken with the World Cup trophy, so that was pretty cool to see. So fans were very excited, and they were treated to some pretty good soccer. I thought Brazil really did a good job with their high pressure, and it was it was a case of the U.S. just biding their time and making the most of their chances and being very dangerous on the counterattack a lot of the times. Morgan had a second goal that was wiped out on an offside, which it was very close. I'll say that. I think she might have been maybe a couple inches offside, but certainly it was very close. And Crystal Dunn scored. Brazil scored right before the half in stoppage time, and there's one of those goals you go, oh no, going into the half and they score. But before they even got to the half, Crystal Dunn got it back. So it was 2-1 at the break. And then late heroics for Stephanie McCaffrey, her first cap. She gets her first goal. And then Morgan also had another chance to score, and she missed the net entirely. It was so Rivas of her. did you guys get to catch the game?
I was there, too. I was down at the end where so basically the Brazil goal, first of all, which was a great goal. Probably one of the best goals I've seen in women's soccer in a long time, just the build-up and the bend to beat Hope Solo. I was really excited just about the crowd too. What I did notice was that it was a different makeup of people who were attending that game. Yes, there was some crossover, but there was actually a whole different market for the women's game. And that made me excited because there's a women's team coming to town, and seeing those people get really excited about the women, the U.S. women's team, just knows that that passion is here in this city.
Yeah, and it showed this week when the big announcement came on Monday, the day after the U.S. women's national team win. Alex Morgan was introduced as a new player for the Orlando Pride. Sarah Hagen and Kaylin Kyle also coming over. Morgan and Kyle arriving in a trade from Portland Thorns, and Hagen in a separate deal with FC Kansas City. And, you know, Kansas City was Hagen in a draft pick for a draft pick, and Morgan and probably a backdoor deal not to select certain players in the expansion draft. And Morgan and Kyle come over for an international slot in 2016 and 17. And the rights to the first player chosen in the expansion draft, which will be Megan Klingenberg, and also the first pick in the college draft. So Portland gets a lot out of it. But also, you know, Orlando Pride didn't give up as much as we were led to believe they were going to give up. And there was no mention of the rights to Lindsay Horan, so who played, by the way, on the Sunday. And Ashlyn Harris did not. We do expect Ashlyn Harris to be in Orlando Pride purple come 2016. So it was a good turnout, fans and media, for this announcement, and I thought that it went very well, and it was it was quite a splash on Sunday. Daniel, what do you make of this beginning trio of signings for Tom Sermonti's club?
You know, if they all three can stay on the pitch, it's gonna be great. I mean, you have to look at two forwards that have shown not only in the league in WSL, but also internationally, that they can play at a high level. And Kaylin Kyle in the midfield. I mean, and these three ladies are also faces of a franchise, right? I mean, you have to think about a few of our first signings, of course, Kaká, and then Tally Hall, and Kugo didn't work out with City so much, but those were faces of a franchise, and that's what they did here. And the Pride made some fantastic moves, because when you're talking about Morgan and being able to market these three ladies, you now have the ability to market not only in the U.S. but in Canada as well, as Kaylin Kyle's a very popular player there, and Sarah Hagen's a big up and coming star as well in my eyes, because she has a lot of tools in her game. So they build an identity. I mean, it looks like they're going to be an attacking style team again, like City is, control the ball. And I'm interested to see what they do in the expansion draft coming up here, because there's a lot of options now, a lot of backdoor dealings with the expansion draft, as we know, with getting these players from the Thorns and from Kansas City. So I'm interested to see who's available technically and who's not. I think Heather O'Reilly's off the table from Kansas City, but there's still a lot of good players out there in expansion draft, and I'm excited to see who we get Monday.
Yeah, I'm very excited about this. It's going to be really cool. The great thing about it is we don't have to share this with another team like we did in MLS.
Yep.
This expansion draft is just all, hey, give me that person, give me that person. And you don't have to really strategize who are they going to take, because there's no they. So I'm real anxious to see how Tom Sermonti builds a team. He had some great comments, and Austin David wrote a story about it this week on our site. You can go to themainland.com and read that. He, Tom Sermonti basically said, I want to build a culture of winning, and I want to build this team the right way, with a mixture of, experienced players, a mixture of young players, a few internationals. And he's already out scouting the colleges. He's been to UCF games and that kind of thing. And there's some good college soccer in the state of Florida. FSU has a good program, and UCF has a good program, and the academy system is already fully in place on the women's side. So the future for the Orlando Pride looks really good. I know there were some people around the country that sort of scoffed at the amount of assets that were parted with to get Alex Morgan, but I think when you throw in Kaylin Kyle, And maybe the trade wasn't as lopsided as people think, especially because it really all depends on what you put around those players, Andrew, to determine if this was a good trade or not. You have to really look at the whole once opening day comes in 2016.
Well, you have to look at the whole for what's going to be available in the expansion draft, what Samani's wanting to do, but what you also have to do is look to the future. You know, picks are something that people put a lot of weight in, but realistically, when you start getting there, you don't know who's even going to be available. And quite often, by the time, if you are hoping for a successful season, you know, the depth doesn't have great talent past the first five players that are franchise players. So you have to question, is that something we're really giving up, especially if we're going to have the ability to build our own products from a younger age, because we've got a full academy set up and we've got a coach that has been in the women's game for a really long time and has potentially already identified talent that would be available through other mechanisms other than the NWSL draft. I think this is, once again, another proof that Orlando City is doing this the right way. They are taking the risks and hoping for success, and they're all in rather than just being like, you know, let's be a little bit skeptical, let's hope for that one person potentially going to opt for the draft. They are actually just saying, no, we're going to want to win from day one, and this is how we're going to do it, and you have to admire that.
Yeah, and Alex Morgan is she's a face of the franchise type, and it's, you know, a lot of people have made a big deal about her being injured often and that kind of thing, but there was another guy who had some knee injuries that is the face of Orlando City, and he had a pretty good year, and that's Kaká. Alex Morgan is a much different player than Kaká because she's very young, still in her prime, and if she returns to form, you know, it's easily worth what they paid because she could go out there and score. She could go out there and score. I mean, they only played 20 games. She could score 20 goals.
Yep.
She could. People talking about what you're giving up to. You're starting a new franchise. We couldn't have started a new franchise with the number one pick in the expansion draft or the number one pick in the college draft. We started a new franchise with two very popular, marketable females in Kaylin Kyle and Alex Morgan, who the Orlando City will come to love. The Pride will come to love. I mean, Alex Morgan has roots here as well. We have to remember that relationship with Darwin Carrasco. So I think that's going to be a driver for her moving forward. I you know, she did miss a lot of games with the Thorns over the past few years. She scored 15 goals in 36 appearances, but she missed a lot of games with injuries, a lot of international time. But I think that's why we went out and got Hagen as well, who doesn't necessarily play as much internationally. And she's done well with Kansas City over the past couple of years. So we're building that depth there up front. But we have a face of our franchise for the Pride moving forward. That was the most important thing. We weren't going to build that from college, and it was going to be very difficult getting it out of the expansion draft.
And much easier to build a buzz when you have maybe arguably the world's most popular female player.
She's on the front of FIFA, guys.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a win, and, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, her marriage to Servando Carrasco presumably means Servando is not going anywhere for the foreseeable future.
Fantastic.
And, you know, a lot of the things that have happened, people say, well, they could have taken Klingenberg, they could have taken this person, that person, but I think a lot of what has happened in terms of who's been left unprotected was all predicated on the fact that Portland was going to make this deal. Now, Klingenberg may have been available, or, you know, maybe they roll the dice that you don't want to spend the money on Carly Lloyd. Houston had three players. They had to leave one unprotected. So they made a deal that will help them because they were going to lose somebody anyway. You know, Washington goes out and they leave a couple of Americans unprotected because they know Ashlyn Harris wants to come here. And if we take Megan Klingenberg and then take Ashlyn Harris, we cannot take Allie Krieger. So she was left unprotected. So and then Kansas City did what they needed to do. They said, well, we can't protect everybody, but we don't want to lose Heather O'Reilly. So how can we get around this? Maybe we'll see if they want Sarah Hagen. And so I think everything has worked out. I think all the teams involved here make out, you know, just fine, and they all did what they needed to do. And I'm really excited for November 2nd to see how the roster kind of fills out, and then it'll fill out beyond then. The real interesting thing to me, Tom Cermani has been head coach of the Australian women's national team, the U.S. women's national team, and has been assistant on the Canadian women's national team. So presumably there are few, if any, coaches in NWSL that know the talent pool like Tom Cermani does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's been around the block, and he's seen the fact that we even need scouts for this club. I don't think we do. I think Tom could probably do it by himself. He's been to a lot of different camps, and when we're talking about three nations that play in NWSL predominantly, even though Australia has its own league, those are three of the top nations. And you're talking about, you know, Katrina Gorey out there with FC, who's left unprotected, probably one of the best attacking midfielders available. I don't know if we're going to be able to take her. She might have been part of the conversation with the Hagen deal. But there's a lot of players out there that, you know, even with Ashlyn Harris, who I think is pretty much a done deal with us taking Klingenberg and Harris, we're not going to be able to take another U.S. international, but there's a lot of good players out there. FC does have Leanne Brown, who's a 29-year-old center back who played every minute in NWSL last year, and it's very, very good. So there's a lot you can do in the expansion draft. And if you would have told me we had Ashlyn Harris, Kaylin Kyle, Sarah Hagen, and Alex Morgan, and we gave up a first-round pick in the college draft, an international spot for 2 years, and a first-round pick in the expansion draft, I would have taken that deal every day of the week.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing too. You might see Orlando City or Orlando Pride. I keep saying that. You might see Tom Cermani and Orlando Pride take players and then move them on to get international slots back.
Yeah.
Those conversations are taking place too. This mechanism is going to help Orlando City, and it's just a matter of how they use those assets. They can use them to select players that they want to play on the team, or they can use them to select players that other teams want on their team. I think this team will probably try to go out and get some more international slots, because I'm sure that Tom Cermani's got his eyes on some people that have been out there, and I think that certainly the ownership would probably like to have a Brazilian on the team. And there are some Brazilians out there that are available, and there are quite a few players. I was surprised at the number of Canadian internationals that are available in this expansion draft. So
I think that's just because of the sheer lack of international spots, but you never know. And the fact is, we just don't know what has already happened. But the one thing that concerns me a little bit is we're picking up all this great talent, but this is also a league that wants to continue to expand. Remember, if we're in this situation 12 months from now, we can only protect two U.S. women's players because another franchise is coming in. We don't want to have also gathered all the goodies because we won't be able to protect them all.
Yeah, but then we could just make the same deals like the Dash did and that kind of thing. So, or Kansas City. One thing that I wanted to bring up too is that Phil Rollins came out at the U.S. Women's National Team game at halftime and told us, the media gathered there, that the pre-sale sold more than 1,300 season tickets for the Pride. 1,300 in about a week. And that was, I mean, pretty impressive already, because this is a women's soccer league. And the second thing he said was that that's ahead of where the MLS team pre-sale was. So I wonder, Andrew, what do you think reasonably we can expect as an average attendance for Pride games in 2016?
I have really no statistics to base it on other than the U.S. women's game and the growth of this game overall, but I think I'm going to give it pretty comfortably around the Thorns numbers and say probably around 10,000 a game. I think if we're already in that terms of pre-sale and for season tickets, you know, that's already 15% towards that goal. We've still got 4 months of roster building and scheduling and seeing how it all pans out. I'm going to say you can get comfortably 10 and aim to start to challenge the Thorns at the 15 mark.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, how many do you think will be in the bowl on opening day for the Pride?
Oh, for opening day, I think probably 20,000. I think close to
really?
That number. Yeah, I really think it'd be 18,000 to 20,000. I think it's because of Alex Morgan. I think you're going to see us bring in. You have to remember, we might only have two international slots. That's going to be very fluid, though. This year, I think they'll probably go back to three for the 2016 season. Don't be surprised if we don't get a big-name Brazilian, because we have a hole in attacking midfield. There's not a lot out there. Adriana Leon is a good Canadian attacking midfielder. She's available, but I wouldn't be surprised if we brought in a big Brazilian to add to that to add to the Alex Morgan name and get close to 18 to 20,000 people in the bowl for opening Pride game.
I think we're going to get more.
Yeah, I'm going a lot higher than that.
I think opening day will be better. I don't think it'll be 65 and fill the bowl, but I think we're going to get closer to maybe 30, somewhere between 30 and 35, maybe.
You think for opening game for 30 to 35? Wow.
Just for opening day, because I think they're going to really push it. I think they're going to really try to sell it. I think the marketing – I have a lot of faith in Orlando City's marketing department, the way that they do things. There'll be a lot of events where they they'll probably like have an event every night leading up to the first game, just like they did in MLS. And at those events, they'll probably be some ticket giveaways. So I think they'll help those numbers with some giveaways and with some promotions. But I expect more than 20 on opening day for sure.
Well, you got to remember the record is 19,000 for an NWSL game. So I mean, I don't know if I could put another 10,000 on top of that. I was shooting for around that number, maybe a little bit higher, but another 10,000 on top of that's a big number. Even with Alex Morgan's name on the ticket, I mean that's pretty big.
That's true. I think this market may surprise some with women's soccer because of how many really high quality programs there are in youth girls soccer here. I think there's people like me who were soccer dads who got used to the women's game, you know, as their daughters grew up. And like I have a daughter in college right now who played State Cup, and I really grew to enjoy the women's game just as much as the men's game. And I think like Phil Rollins said, there's some crossover with the demographics, but they really have their own demographics for women's soccer, and the NWSL I think will do very well here. And again, I don't think they're going to get, you know, that many every game, but I certainly think they're going to make a splash on opening day, and I think they're going to make a point of doing that. So that's just my take. We'll see. Guys, why don't we turn our attention back to the men's side? Orlando City heading into its first MLS off season. And I want to start with you, Andrew, and find out what do you think. Tell me three things you think Orlando City will do in the off season. It doesn't necessarily have to be a player move, but what do you think will happen? Three things we can expect Orlando City to do in the off season.
I'm not going to be too nitty gritty about it, but they're going to shift some dead weight, free up some cap room. I think you're going to see one big shock move that nobody is expecting. Either a player has grown into his reputation or somebody that they shift to move for cap room for another big player. And I really think that you're going to see almost a complete sea change potentially in how we do business because of the fact that we now have, for all intents and purposes, our own farm team, and we can take a risk on somebody without potentially damaging our season too much. So those are going to be my three things. Trim dead weight. There's going to be a shock move that people aren't expecting, and we are going to take more risks than we did this season.
All right, Daniel, give me your three things we can expect Orlando City to do in the offseason.
One would be to get another player that can put the ball in the back of the net. Besides Kyle Larin, hey, he had a fantastic season, and I think he should be up top, but we need a player running off of him. We don't necessarily have that. We have Kaká, who likes to operate with the ball, but we don't have a player that runs it off of Kyle Larin, who got better as the season went on. I want to see someone there that has that relationship with him. I think that would be number one. Number two is, depending upon Tally Hall's knee injury, I don't think they trust Josh Ford to be a goalkeeper in MLS, and I think that they are going to go out and get someone either through a move in MLS or someone from the outside of MLS coming in to fill that role. And I'm going to say number three is synergy. Synergy with our Orlando City B and with the Pride as well, not only through teams and the club nature and building from the bottom up with B and Orlando City B and Orlando City, but also the marketing effect. You're going to see Orlando be dominated by purple, even if it already was not. It's going to be even more now. With Alex Morgan driving the Pride, with Kaká and Kyle Larin probably as a face as well driving Orlando City, this whole town, if you thought it was purple in February and March and April this year, wait till next year. It's going to be, the whole town's going to be painted purple. It's going to be insane.
All right. I like it. I like all of those things. I'm going to say, first of all, Orlando City, I expect we'll sign a designated player in the offseason.
Yeah.
I don't know what position that will be at, but I think that Paul McDonough will bring in and Adrian Heath will bring in a designated player. It might not be a big name designated player, but I think you know, the designated players that have been brought in that haven't been big names have actually done very, very well here. I think a lot of people didn't know who Federico Higuain was before he came here. They knew his brother. I think a lot of people didn't know who Rivero was up in Vancouver before he got here. I think they're going to bring in maybe somebody of that nature. It may not be from South America, maybe European, but I expect the DP to arrive on these shores, and then they can use the target allocation money to pay down one of the young DPs to a regular salary contract. That's number one. Number two, I think you're going to see this team maybe try to up its game in terms of the friendlies that they get. I think that Phil, I'm almost calling him Phil Collins because the announcement came out. Announcement came out today about Phil Collins is going to come back, make a new album, and tour again. But I think Phil Rollins wants to see if this team can get in on those large summer pseudo tournaments, you know, with the big clubs that come over from Europe. I think so. There might be a little bit of a shift in what we see in terms of the friendlies. And my third thing that I think will happen off season, and it's kind of a cheat because it's going to happen actually the minute that this season begins, is I think they're going to fill the bowl again for opening day. So that'll be my third thing. So I think those are three things that, and if you take all of our collective nine things and do all of those, then I think it's going to be a pretty eventful off season.
Definitely a lot to write about.
Yeah, well, that's good. We're a blog. We have things that we need to talk about here on the podcast, and we got things we need to write about on the blog. By the way, before I forget, since the season is over, we're going to our monthly off-season podcast schedule. So we won't be back till like mid to late November, and then we're going to go once in November, once in December, once in January, once in February, and we'll lead into the 2016 season. We may have special editions of the podcast if something big happens. Like, it's not going to happen now, but if it had happened that, like, Chicharito got signed, then we would probably come back and talk about that and have a special edition. But so we're going to monthly. So, you know, you guys can, you know, you don't have to feel like you need to listen to us every week, because I know you do. But
don't get them out of their groove, man. They're yep. so used to yeah. it. You know, we'll be back next Wednesday. We'll do expansion draft for the Orlando Pride. If anything, I'll have to do it by myself. But
yeah, well, we all need to recharge our batteries. I'm actually working. I'm trying to get a new. I'm trying to find a host that's a little bit more slick than I am, and I would like to maybe take a step back and do some more of the, you know, the commentary and that kind of thing, and maybe let somebody else run the thing and put the thing together, because I got a lot on my plate.
Come on, my color thing. Commentary is strong over here.
What? I didn't say you were going to be fired or anything like that. So anyway,
I'm going the way of Kevin Hartman. Thanks, guys.
It's been a great season to be an Orlando City fan. You only get your expansion year one time, and I think we all enjoyed the ride. I think there were times that it was a little bit frustrating because we saw how good this team could be when they were firing on all cylinders. But we all knew that there were holes, and we all knew that there were depth issues, and those actually came into play. And part of sports is if you suffer a lot of injuries, it affects your season. That certainly happened to be the case with Orlando City. It's been really fun to be part of this ride, and hopefully next year we'll be on to bigger, better things. I trust that Adrian Heath will get it done. I trust that Paul McDonough will build the depth of the club, and I trust that the fans will keep coming out and supporting the team. So those are the three things I think we can count on going into 2016. We didn't talk about yet is that Orlando City has got a friendly in November, and that's going to be down in Brazil, and there were all kinds of things that were going to happen in Brazil last year, and then all of a sudden they didn't happen, and Orlando went to Charleston instead, which is not the same thing as Brazil, believe it or not. But they're going to be playing Flamengo as part of their, 120th anniversary celebration. So it's weird because now we're the team in the off season going in to play a team that's going down their stretch run right now in Brazil, and I believe our own Andrew Harrison right here is going to be at that game.
I am going to try to make it. I want to see what we can do, and I feel like this is actually This is obviously a makeup game for the fact that we didn't get down there. This is a great marketing ploy by them. And hey, if they're getting me to fly halfway around the world to go see them play, I guess they got something right.
Yeah. A very popular club in Brazil is Orlando City. I mean, in terms of MLS, you know, all the games are broadcast there. And, you know, Flavio was saying, you know, owner Flavio Augusto da Silva was saying that, you know, some of the teams that are there don't have all their games televised, but every Orlando City game is televised in Brazil. So that's pretty impressive, actually, when you think about it. I don't think this is a game where Orlando City is going to really think about the result. I think this is just going to be a run out for the guys, and if they happen to do well, they happen to do well. But I don't think this is a game where they're going to go all out to win, Daniel.
Well, you know, I don't think so either. But the chance to get into play in the Maracanã in Rio for them is going to be fantastic against a very storied club. And, you know, like you said, it didn't work out last time. But I think this time around, you could see a lot of our youth that we currently have on our roster getting a go. I mean, I believe Kaká is going to be for the Brazilian national team, actually World Cup qualifiers against Argentina and Peru at that time. So I don't necessarily see the guys that are up there in age, like Luis Neal and others, going down there and playing in this match unless they just, you know, tell Adrian, hey, I want to get some minutes in Rio. But you could see our young guys getting out there. Same thing from Flamengo as well, putting their young guys out there and pitting a battle in Rio. I think it'll be good to watch, and you know, hopefully it'll be broadcasted here. We know it's going to be broadcasted in Brazil. I'm more worried about the broadcast here.
Yeah, we'll see if it maybe gets streamed or something. But if Andrew goes, we're going to try to get him credentialed so he can cover it for the mainland, which would be really cool. We might be the first SB Nation blog, MLS blog, to actually cover games in multiple countries.
Let's make this happen.
Yeah. Not counting, I mean, I guess Canada and the U.S., I'm sure they've done that before, but
so there's
South America.
There's a GoFundMe for Andrew now.
No, Andrew's doing this on his dime because we don't have any money. And, you know, the GoFundMe is that if he wants to do that, that's great. But you know how that goes. If you're not promising the world, you're probably not going to get, you know, all that money. But, yeah, so it's going to be cool to see. I think you might see some runouts for some guys who might be trying to save their spot on the team. I think if you think of a guy like Eric Avila or a guy like Pedro Ribeiro or somebody like that who is wanting to be on the 2016 roster, they might, you know, want to see what they can do and show, especially Ribeiro, since he's Brazilian. I think he'll certainly play a major role in that match.
The best thing that those two guys can do, and Avila and Ribeiro, to stay on this roster, and this may be a bit taboo, but I'm going to say it, is start dating an Orlando Pride girl. That's the only thing that they're going to be able to do because, you know, I've been on Ribeiro's case all year long, and I just, I mean, besides having good footwork, the guy just, he is so entirely slow. It's like playing FIFA and turning the speed level all the way down. He walks like Darth Vader on the pitch. I mean, it's just like the slowest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And Eric Avila, for all the hype that I had for him coming into the season, unfortunately, he didn't hold up. Maybe he was just playing too many positions, not exactly know what he was doing at the right wing spot, but he just looked like a black hole over there on the right side all year long. So nothing against you guys. You might be the nicest people on the planet, but, you know, whenever it's bad, it's bad.
Well, I know Eric Avila always came. He was his role was always the utility knife. He was going to be the all-in-one tool that you could plug in just about anywhere if you needed him. And he was never intended to be, you know, multi-game in a row starter and get, you know. But you know, the good thing is they had a veteran player when they needed a veteran player, and you know that unfortunately they did need one, and you know. He was the break glass in case of emergency, and they broke the hell out of that glass all year.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I think we've pretty much covered all of the topics du jour. I want to thank everyone who listened during the season. Remember, we're not going away. We're just going to a monthly schedule for the off season. I figure that way, you know, we can keep these at a reasonable length. And if we tried to go, you know, weekly with an off season, typically we would probably do about 15 minutes most weeks. But, you know, we appreciate you guys listening. And of course, you follow us on Twitter at TheMainland, TheMainland. And you read us at themainland.com. We appreciate our readers. We appreciate our listeners. And we will see you in November. On behalf of Daniel McGann and Andrew Harrison, I'm Michael Citro. As always, signing off, saying, go City!